sacred space, I'd make you one less equivalent to this stuff.
You may have noticed that I'm the first speaker and possibly the last speaker who's not going to avail of the technical facilities available here. It's very simple. There's a very simple reason for that. I'm a historian. I'm also a historian of colonialism, which means that, unfortunately, and as a change, I will not be treating you to more visuals. I will not be treating you to archaeology. I'll be treating you to the archive. Therefore, you just have to listen to me talk. My work relies very largely on the text, on the archive. And it's not a bad idea, because I find that visuals also take up a lot of time. I'm totally incompetent. Now, the point is that although I deal with the archive, the topic of the paper relates to a certain historicization of many of the things that were discussed earlier today, chiefly how the text fits in with archaeological studies. And my work is on heritage and monument making in colonial India, and this is, if you like, an offshoot of the kind of discourse and practice of monument making that one finds in late 19th and early 20th century India. Now, what I'm going to present are very early findings, so I'm very grateful to the organizers of this conference, particularly to Himanshu Pabare, for giving me the opportunity to present these very early thoughts here, and especially since there are many archaeologists, numismatists, and epigraphists here with whom I certainly hope to gain. I would also like to thank Jessica Fraser for all the trouble that she took to organize this conference. And one other very brief word of warning. You will find that I will be using a number of terms which rather loosely, and I'd like to say it right at the beginning that I will be using them in their discursive sense, in other words, in the way in which they were used in the documents that I have dealt with. So the title of the paper is repeated once again, Sacred Space in the Making of Monuments in Colonial Orissa, and I'm really going to be limiting my talk to the early 20th century for reasons that I hope to address in the paper. In a note describing his recent visit to the Jagannath Temple in Puri in the course of his inspection tour of Orissa in 1904, the new Director General of Archaeology in India, John Marshall, gave the following account. I quote, it's an account that one comes across quite often. In front of the east gate of the Jagannath Temple and standing in the middle of the high road is a well-known pillar from the Black Pagoda at Konarak. Around it is a small pavement of rough stones across which one naturally steps when wishing to look at the carving on the pillar. I myself did so without a suspicion that I could be giving any offence, and was at once subjected to a great deal of abuse and threats from a gang of pestilential natives who had been lying about, backed afterwards by the temple police. There was no notice or indication of any kind to show that the pavement was sacred ground, and I saw no reason, therefore, for paying regard to their threats. If the government decide that the pavement is sacred and belongs indisputably to the temple, then it should be fenced, and a notice warning people not to step on it should be posted up. But if, on the other hand, there is no real sanctity attached to the pavement, and if it is mere perversity and ill nature on the part of the Hindus that induces them to obstruct Europeans in this way, then the rights of Europeans should be insisted on. Surely it is enough that the Hindus close the compound of their temple to Europeans. Or must they go further and usurp the high road too? The sacred as a contested space in colonial power relations in British India has drawn much scholarly attention. A very good example of this is the case of living Hindu temples, and I use the word living in the sense in which it was used then, and their management by the colonial state, which usually took the form of restriction of their economic autonomy by controlling the land endowments which provided them with this autonomy. In the policy and practice of preserving India's pre-colonial architecture and the creation of monuments, this was a central issue, as some recent research on the subject has indicated. The sharp distinction that was made between the sacred and the secular in European monument-making practices in the 19th century is well known. In the colonial context, this distinction acquired a sharper and more ideological meaning, especially since archaeology in India was an enterprise of the colonial state. Thus, the practice of restoring ancient religious structures and their subsequent metamorphosis into monuments under the guidance of colonial archaeology rested on some of the assumptions that were fundamental to colonial power relations, namely an interpretation of Indian history as a story of degeneration and decline caused by corrupt political and religious systems, a teleological understanding of British rule in India as the bearer of progress, unity, secularism, and history, and a belief in the role of archaeology and conservation of monuments as agents of progress in a culture that, as 19th century British historians emphatically claimed, lacked history. This paper looks at archaeological discourse and practice with reference to the Hindu temples of the so-called Golden Triangle in colonial Orissa, and tries to examine how the making of monuments and associated practices made out of sacred space contested sites. It will also show how far the strict division that was made in theory between secular and sacred spaces was in practice tenable, and how contested sites in turn became negotiated and negotiable space. Now, there's a bit that I had written in the paper on general colonial practices monument making, which I'm sure you'll agree I can skip. I want to talk a bit about Orissa itself in colonial discourse and certainly the way in which the temples of Orissa traditionally figured in colonial writings, and I use the term colonial discourse in a very loose sense to accommodate all kinds of discourses. However, as far as the temples at least are concerned, writing on Orissan temples was dominated, let's say, by two things. One was Jagannath, of course. And Jagannath, seen both from the missionary accounts to official accounts which were heavily influenced by evangelical ideas, representing degeneration and the same kind of colonial topos of history, religious degeneration of India, and Jagannath is really quintessentially representative of this. And the other thing was the other way in which these temples feature is as scholars like Yamini Mubai have shown recently, that the company and later the Raj government systematically tried to gain influence over the temple and its resources, even though in theory the temples were autonomous. I mean, these are the two things that dominate: economic control over the temple, which becomes obviously a map of political control, and the second thing is, as I said, the notion of religious degeneration. Now, it's against this specificity of the discourse on Orissan temples that one can understand conservation practices in Orissa. Now, the main marker was the year 1904, largely because of the enactment of the Ancient Monument Preservations Act, which legalizes a number of things, codifies what monument preservation was all about, and of course sets about a whole lot of new factors in motion. Now, the Act itself envisaged no role for awarding protection to religious, in other words, monuments were not religious, could not be religious in terms of practice. In other words, temples where worship was still being practiced were not to be brought the Act was not to apply in them. Now, the major temples of coastal Orissa, the Jagannath Temple and the Lingaraj the Jagannath at Puri and the Lingaraj at Bhubaneswar, turned out to be major test cases for this principle of whether this distinction between living and non-living temples could actually be maintained. In the years after the passing of the Act, and especially in the 1910s, the personal interest and consequent intervention on the path of both the first Viceroy, Curzon, and the new Director General, John Marshall, saw increasing attempts to control, regulate, demarcate, and legalize sacred space in the temples of Orissa that were still in use. The result was a number of conflicts, but also negotiations over sacrality versus the rights of, vis-a-vis the rights of archaeology. In the case of the Orissan temple, such conflicts and negotiations took place in what I have identified as over three issues which were mutually related. The first was the issue of temple ownership and the awarding of protected status. In other words, who owned the temple and under what circumstances would a temple be declared protected and therefore be eligible for government grants for restoration and conservation. Second, the right of entry into the temples, which becomes, as I've shown you right in the first quotation itself, how important that was. And third, the physical separation of the religious from the public domain, and this requires some amount of concretization, which I'll get to at the end. So the first issue first, temple ownership and protection. Now, the question of protection of religious structures, such as temples still in use, was closely related to the issue of control of the rights to undertake independent conservation work, which in turn was related to the issue of ownership. Now, the Act of 1904 laid down clear and specific criteria according to which protected monuments, as is common knowledge, protected monuments were to be classified and this determined whether they had access to funds for repair or not. Of the monuments deemed worthy of preservation, the Department of Archaeology further divided them into two categories based on ownership, and this is where ownership was central. The two categories were A, whether the monuments were owned and maintained by the government, or B, by private persons, or C. This third category came up really in 1904 itself, but really it became more common practice in the early 1920s, mid-1910s, about 1915. And this provision related to monuments that were owned privately, but maintained either jointly by the owners and the state, or exclusively by the state. I mean, there's a conflation of categories which embodies much potential for conflict. Since the vast majority of structures in private ownership were non-secular, the potential for conflict over sacred space could not, from the early days of the enforcement of the Act, of the Ancient Monument Preservation Act, be ruled out. In the case of the Bhubaneswar temples, the archaeological department were confronted with this problem from fairly early on. John Marshall insisted the state clearly lay down and adhere to a consistent policy in Bhubaneswar, urging the classification of monuments according to ownership and use for religious purposes. And these two criteria he kept stressing should be used. A, who owned them, and B, whether they were places of worship or not. He also recommended that in view of the large number of temples in Bhubaneswar, those used for religious purposes not be taken into consideration for protection at all, but that control of secular private monuments should pass into the hands of the state. This view seems to prevail in general among the officials of the regional archaeological department as well. However, in the case of the temples of Bhubaneswar, it was not always easy. This was illustrated by two cases of temple demolition in Bhubaneswar in the years 1910 and 11. And it's quite interesting that they are two very different, it's about the demolition of two temples under very different circumstances, but the story, the way I read it, is the same or very similar. The first of these temples is a small temple that was a part of the Ananta Vasudev temple complex in Bhubaneswar, whose demolition was begun by the Public Works Department. The other was the temple of Podesuri, which was a part of the Lingaraj complex and was demolished by the temple committee itself. Now, the demolition work in the Ananta Vasudev temple complex was started without consulting the Bhubaneswar temple committee, which was in charge of the temple, and became a matter of some embarrassment to the colonial government. It's quite interesting that the temple committee protests immediately, and there's a number of letters registering their displeasure at the way you know, matters had been taken out of their hands and that they hadn't been consulted at all in the matter. As far as the Padesari temple was concerned, the temple committee had to explain its actions, why it had demolished this particular temple. But as I said, both cases presented a common problem, that of a lack of clarity in the legal arrangements regarding who had the ultimate authority over the temple, the state or the committee. And as I said, the temple committee responds rather angrily to what it perceives as government intervention in matters of conservation. But the interesting thing is the way in which regional archaeology, represented by the Superintendent of Archaeology, Eastern Circuit, Edith Spooner, responds. And regional archaeology takes great pains to stress that it's absolutely essential that ownership be determined in Orissa, that legal arrangements are first worked out, and then do government intervene. But this is something, what I'm trying to really get at, is that nothing is really done. I mean, till 1918, nothing is codified, and the government still gives money and tries to assume control, but it's not, nothing is clear. And, I see that as quite an important thing, and why I should tell you in my conclusion. Now, however, regional archaeology stressed continuously that as far as temples in use were concerned, the government should either take these temples over or not provide any aid whatsoever. The second part of the second problem that I referred to was the question of temple entry, and I deal with this question in relation to the controversy around the Lingaraja temple. Now, what happened in the case of the Lingaraja temple was that the temple itself had always been under the custodianship of the Bhubaneswar Temple Committee. The government had initially been fairly uncertain about providing money for conservation work. However, in the early 1900s, the Temple Committee for the first time got a grant of 400 rupees towards the repair of the temple. Grants were discontinued in 1903 as the temple authorities refused to let European officials into the enclosure in order to inspect the work being done. Now, proposals had been made awarding or recommending that the Lingaraja be awarded protected status. However, this never bore fruition, and there was one major reason for that, a reason that was often quoted, and that was the right of entry into the temple complex. This right had been traditionally reserved exclusively for the Hindus and appears to have been a peculiar feature of the Orissan temples at the time. And I don't mean entry into the temple itself, but into the enclosure. And this is something that, in the Curzon era in particular, becomes very, very irksome for the colonial state. And there are accounts written by Curzon that those of you who've seen these files will be very familiar with. I mean, how angry he is that the government provides money for conservation being to take place, but does not, and the central issue is this, that it does not, the government provides money but is not authorized to send qualified people, namely Europeans, into the temple complex to see what is going on. Quite interestingly, Curzon says things like, talks about how he refers to how European engineers are not allowed into the complex, and who knows, he speaks about the particular British engineer who was on site, but who had not been admitted into the interior, and might, and I quote here, for all that he knew, be humbugged or swindled at every turn by his native subordinates. So essentially it's about the sole competence of these men to supervise and conduct repairs. Now, from 1903 till 1918, when all the Bhubaneswar temples were finally struck off the list of protected structures, the discourse on government control of conservation work on the temples centered to a very great extent on the denial of the right of admission to non-Hindus, whereby the term was used interchangeably with Europeans. In the various interpretation of the Act of 1904 that the Department of Archaeology put forward, there is ample reference to temples in use for religious purposes being closed to the public. In effect, however, the question was about allowing European officers of the archaeological department into the temple. The intransigence of both the Temple Committee and the government on this point led to an impasse which seems to vex the regional archaeological officers considerably. Regional archaeology, on the other hand, tended to be much more pragmatic about this, and I think this is quite an important thing, because much of the time, in most discussions of colonial archaeological practice, these practices are seen as a sort of a monolithic, homogeneous phenomenon, and that's clearly not the case. Obviously, men who were closer, and I use the word men very consciously and knowingly, who are closer to the local, working at the local level, who were very well aware of the problems that were associated with excessive intervention on the part of the state, tended to adopt a more pragmatic attitude. The final point, how much time do I have? Mm-hmm. It's 10 minutes. So about five. I'll try to limit myself to 5 so we can have some time for discussion. The final problem that I spoke about was separating the secular and the sacred. And I take the incidents, I've called the section in the essay, the pillar, the fence, and the temple. One of the fundamental assumptions of colonial conservation practices was the belief in the clear and physical demarcation of space for monuments. According to the principles of monument conservation that were laid down in the wake of the Act of 1904, the need to define clearly the space of the monument was central to the creation of a monument. And this is nothing, there's nothing specifically colonial about it, but the implementation in a context that is not that does not have a tradition of this kind of monumentification is the interesting part of the story. Now, this could be done, the demarcation of space could be done by means of acquiring the land around it, its beautification, its protection from possible damage by means of fencing it, and defining its territory by means of notice boards. And it's quite interesting how much correspondence there is purely on the notice boards. And I didn't want to bring that in, but the notice board keeps figure. I mean, it would be very interesting if you wrote a book on it to actually put a notice board of, with the Act of 1904 on it, as is common to monuments in India today. But how they are, in what language they are to appear, and at what distance. I mean, these are very, very specifically set down, or the attempt is there to actually codify these things. Now, this was a difficult enough principle to put into practice on non-religious buildings, but the transference of such ideas onto religious structures was fraught with problems, as the case of the pillar at the Jagannath Temple in Puri would show. For a period of some 3 years between 1905 and 1908, the Arun pillar, which had been uprooted from its original home at the Sun Temple of Konark and placed in front of the Lion's Gate of the Jagannath Temple at Puri by the Marathas in the late 18th century, became the focus of a controversy, the essence of which often repeated itself in the Curzon Marshall eras. Now, I began this presentation with this big section of Marshall's report, but he is not the only one. I mean, there are several, and I'm talking about really a minor. Well, it's not a minor. It's just a minor area, a tract of land around this pillar, which. And the question is whether it ought to be demarcated in some way or not. And again, it's amazing the amount of correspondence there is on this tract of this particular area. The matter at issue was not the pillar itself, but the area around it, which was regarded as sacred, of which, however, there was no physical evidence. In other words, it did not stand in any kind of enclosed space. And this absence of a clear boundary demarcating the area that was regarded as sacred became the cause of much ire. And I've mentioned how this recurs. The language that is used, and I've got a lot of extracts in the essay itself, I don't have to repeat that. The language that is used is indeed the language of imperial hauteur and the description of the indolent and yet fanatical Hindu. I mean, it's always these indolent fanatical Hindus who sort of lying about waiting to, stab a dagger into the backs of all these innocent little European archaeologists who are sort of doing their best, really, to under the circumstances. Now, this corresponds very close to the Orientalist discourse on the colonized subject. In all the descriptions that I've come across, that I've also cited in the essay, the Hindus' religious zeal was not something that the colonial state could afford to ignore, as in its alleged aggressiveness, it manifested a direct threat to the authority of the state and therefore to order. The strong advocacy of fencing or railing the pillar was, I would strongly argue, an attempt to assert control over a situation that, in the absence of clear boundaries, had the potential to get out of hand and could, in the final count, challenge the authority of the colonial state. Finally, as Marshall asserted in no uncertain terms, it was the job of the state and no one else's to decide how much and which part of the area around the pillar was sacred. Thus, the guardianship of the state required not only that sacred space be demarcated and defined, but that the state itself draw the boundaries. Despite this rhetoric of control, however, the plans for fencing came to naught, as in 1908, the government of India gave in to the pressure of strong local feeling against the proposed measure and decided to abandon the project. So, just a couple of words in conclusion then. Separating the sacred from the secular sphere of monument making was thus of central importance to archaeology in colonial India. This became particularly important, as I tried to show, with the passing of the Ancient Monuments Preservation Act, which tried to clearly demarcate the rights of government between the rights of the government and those of the religious communities. By trying to do this, the colonial state was attempting to act inconsistent with its oft-articulated policy of religious neutrality. I mean, there is the constant talk of how only government can ensure peace and goodwill between the two major communities of India. By trying to do this, in practice, however, as the conflicts that repeatedly occurred on these sites indicate, it was not always possible to maintain religious neutrality. A large number of India's architectural heritage consisted of religious structures, either dead or active places of worship. Very often in the case of actual contenders for grants for building repair and conservation, colonial archaeology found itself unable to adhere to the strict division of secular and sacred space that it had set for itself. As self-proclaimed guardian of India's architectural heritage and thereby of India's past, as Curzon had emphasized in his programmatic speech 1900 before the Asiatic Society of Bengal, the colonial state was often drawn into assuming guardianship of religious structures dedicated to worship, which in the years following 1904 underwent an uneasy metamorphosis into historical monuments. However, as Thapati Guhathakurta put it, and I quote, "There was no smooth or clear-cut trajectory by which the secular logic of history and archaeology could establish their sway over the many combative sacred domains of belief and worship," close quotes. But there was more to monument making than merely being the agent of history and archaeology and stumbling into the religious domain. The role of guardian of India's heritage often meant assuming, or trying to assume, control over the religious domain and drawing boundaries between the domains of the secular and the sacred. Nanjot Lahiri speaks of the fear of invasion of the religious sphere that was generated by the archaeological enterprise of conservation, which often entailed highly intrusive practices such as surveying, measuring, and documentation of structures. In the case of the Orissa temples, this fear was often overlaid with considerable ability on the part of the temple authorities to negotiate the religious rights of the community from possible interventions by colonial archaeology. As we've seen, both the critical issues of protecting the community's exclusive right to temple entry, as well as not conceding to the insistence of the state to demarcate and limit sacred space, it was the state that ultimately yielded. The attempt of colonial archaeology to undertake conservation without determining ownership never went unchallenged. And I'm talking about the case of Orissa, about the Golden Triangle purely. Thus, despite the mechanisms of control that were set in motion as a result of the Ancient Monument Preservation Act of 1904, the actual exercise of control was often considerably circumscribed and much more energy accrued to the colonized than the rhetoric of colonial archaeology suggests. Thank you.
Thank you. and what is to be done? Mm-hmm. How are his rights to be protected, not to be protected? Is he completely to be marginalized? Mm-hmm. Which makes it not just a two-way, but you know, a more complex process. And I was wondering, what does a regional archive have to say?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, I was trying to really. Identify the issues. I mean, that was
okay.
more central.
Okay.
And I was really looking at policy making.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
But you're absolutely correct, which is why I did stress, and I could only do that in these 20 minutes,
mm-hmm.
really very very superficially, that it's very hard to isolate. I mean, for all that talk of professionalism and, you know, for all that talk of being professional archaeologists who really knew their business and so on, we all know they weren't.
Yes.
And, but the thing is that this question is always interlinked to the question of, you know, how to deal with the Raja of Khurda. I mean,
mm.
this is central. I left it out because it just opens up can of worms, which I didn't want to really address. It's just absolutely impossible. But certainly, the temple authorities, I mean, I've suggested here that it is one monolithic block, ahistoric. Obviously, that wasn't the case. And there were internal struggles between the Raja of Khurda and the temple authorities, where the colonial state was, if you like, willy-nilly drawn into it. And there's this question of law and order, whose police force should be sent to get. So there is that big debate, certainly. But as I said, I mean, I was really looking at the question rather than the way it actually
Thank you very much. I think we have to follow up now. I did come back with 2:30, and I'm sure some of the things will be taken up in later papers that we discuss this afternoon.
I'm going to go to the next one.